became and remained a rich commercial city. It was a faithful ally of the Roman emperor. Now, in the year AD 26, by that time, the Roman emperors had decided to be worshipped as gods. And so in AD 26, in Smyrna, there was built a temple to the Emperor Tiberius. The pagan Romans had no reason whatever to persecute the Christians merely because they were another religion. Remember, the Roman Empire included many lands with many different religions, and in the city of Rome itself, you could find about as many pagan gods in their temples as you wanted. And to the Romans, one more or less wouldn't have meant anything. But it had reached the point now under the emperors where it was decided that the emperor, even during his lifetime, was to be worshipped as a god. Now, the people who already worshipped a number of pagan gods, and you remember that all these pagan gods were people of no moral character whatsoever, according to their religion, and anybody who could worship anybody that was as evil as these pagan gods were said to be would have no qualms of conscience about worshiping another, even if he knew it was nothing but a man. But the Christians wouldn't. Now, to refuse any worship to the emperor, this wasn't a matter of religious difference. This was a matter of disrespect for the political and military authority of the emperor. And the Romans, dedicated to creating and holding an empire by force and brutality, were not about to see somebody set up not a religious dissent, but a political dissent. They didn't require any elaborate worship at the temple of the emperor. They didn't require regular attendance like we attend now at Christian churches. Once a year, no doubt, would have been sufficient. And all a Christian had to do to escape martyrdom was to toss a little pinch of... To toss a little pinch of incense on the altar in this temple of the emperor, and that was sufficient to show he was respecting the authority of the emperor as not only head of the army, but as divine, and that was that. If he spent the rest of his time worshiping in his own religion, the Romans didn't care. But that concession was one which no Christian could make. He had to recognize one God only, not the Emperor of Rome. And therefore, these Christian martyrs were killed in the most horribly cruel ways because they would not compromise with their conscience. Now that is the explanation for the pagan persecution of the early Christian church. Now you notice that in the beginning of this message to the church at Smyrna, Jesus identifies himself as the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. The church was going into a period of persecution which would bring death to a great many of them. And he was saying, look, I have conquered death. I have risen from the grave, and I can do the same for you. Therefore, while I warn you in advance you're facing martyrdom, don't be worried about it. I gave you life to begin with. I'll give you life again. The name of this city, Smyrna, means myrrh, M-Y-R-R-H. It is a bitter aromatic gum which was used in compounding perfumes and ointments, and still is, even to this day. In the 30th chapter of Exodus, verses 22 to 33, the formula is given for making up a special oil or ointment with which the priests and the furniture of the tabernacle were to be anointed, dedicated to God. And one of the ingredients in this was myrrh. So, here, the name myrrh, again an indication that this was specially dedicated to God. As I say, the taste of myrrh was very bitter. The experience of this would be bitter, but it was their dedication to the highest degree. So he said, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Now he said, ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Well, in prophecy, as you know, a day is symbolic of a year. So you will have tribulation 10 years. Now how are you going to interpret those 10 years? Are you going to say it is a block of 10 consecutive years? Or are you going to say it is 10 periods of persecution, each of which begins in a specific year? Well, as a matter of fact, you can say either one and be right, because both were true. A double fulfillment. Persecution of the Christians by the Roman Empire was based upon 10 separate edicts against them by 10 different emperors. The first by Nero in the year 64. The second by Domitian in the year 95. The third by Trajan in the year 107. The fourth by Hadrian in the year 127. The fifth by Marcus Aurelius in AD 165. The sixth by Emperor Septimius Severus in the year 202. The seventh by Emperor Maximus, the year 235. The eighth by Emperor Decius, AD 249. The ninth by Emperor Valerianus, AD 257. And the tenth and most vicious of all, by the Emperor Diocletian in the year 303. Now it doesn't mean that for those years only they were persecuted. That was the year the law went into effect, which required thereafter, in obedience to that law, they should be persecuted. So you had a constant period of persecution, but these last 10 years were especially vicious. It began with the edict of Emperor Diocletian in 303, and it ended in the year 313, when the new Emperor Constantine gave his edict that the Christian church should hereafter be tolerated. Now, he didn't overthrow paganism, but he said that the Christian religion should be recognized as lawful on an equal footing with any other religion in Rome. Yes, they still had a temple dedicated to Constantine, and they still burned incense to him there, and they had their temples of Jupiter and Venus and the rest of them. But the Christians were no longer persecuted. So here's one time when we can say that from about 100 to definitely and exactly 313 is the period covered by the second phase of the church at Smyrna. The Roman Empire went through several stages of disintegration. At the start, succession to the throne was by lawful inheritance. Then you reached a period, which was pretty common in ancient monarchies, when there was somebody else who stood a little farther down the line, but he would inherit the throne if you died. And a good many ancient kings were even murdered by their own sons, who wanted to take over the throne. And if he wasn't quite that closely related to you, he definitely had no scruples about getting somebody to put a little poison in your breakfast some morning. Then there came a period when there was a scramble to seize the throne by military power. As an emperor died, usually by assassination, the one who could get the support of a sufficiently large percentage of the army was the one who was able to take the throne. And then it reached the point where the army saw that since they were the ones who made emperors anyway, and in fact they deposed one or two also, getting dissatisfied, that they didn't need to wait until they found some ambitious person wanting their support. They could pick their own emperor and put him on the throne. And it was during this last period, when it was a general scramble for power, with intrigue going on within the army to see who could wean away the loyalty of the army from somebody else, in that general scramble for power, that Constantine was one of those seeking by army support to gain the throne. Well, he had about half a dozen or so competitors. You've been told before, of course, that the most vigorous growth of the Christian church has always been in a period of persecution. Those who are in it only to go along for the ride don't have what it takes, and they dropped out. And the ones who had the courage and the enthusiasm were the ones who made up the church, and they were able to attract enough like themselves to keep it growing. So, by Constantine's time, it was estimated that not too far below half of the population of the Roman Empire were at least nominally Christian. Now, Constantine was not a man of great religious fervor. But if you could get the support of one single block who were pretty nearly half the population to begin with, in addition to whatever groups you could get by political methods, you were in a position to gain power, weren't you? So, having still support of the portions of the army who were loyal to him because he was a great general, he suddenly announced he had seen a vision, that against the clouds of the sky he saw there a cross, and over it the motto, "In this sign, conquer." So, he was a Christian. Therefore, lend your support to me, you Christians. Well, they did. He certainly couldn't be worse than any of the others, and probably not as bad. So they backed him, and he did gain the throne. And he immediately published this edict of toleration, that Christians could not be persecuted for their religion. In 313 A.D. Now, he remained a pagan, a sun worshiper, for some time after that. In fact, it wasn't until about 330 A.D. that he became Christian enough to attend Christian religious services. And at that time, he issued another edict which made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. So, with Constantine, the persecution came to an end. Now we come to the third church in this series, the church at Pergamos. By the way, if you start looking that up in encyclopedias and histories and so on, you'll find some variation in the spelling of it. In your Bible, it is Pergamos, P-E-R-G-A-M-O-S. In some encyclopedias and histories, it is called Pergamum, P-E-R-G-A-M-U-M, but it's the same place, whichever spelling they use. Revelation 2, verses 12 to 17. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, "These things saith he which hath the sharp sword with two edges. I know thy works, and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's throne is. And thou holdest fast my name, and hast not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you, where Satan dwelleth. But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. So also hast thou them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I will come unto thee quickly, and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give of a hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it. You really need to know something about your ancient history to understand this one. The city of Pergamos was not of great importance. I mean, in the ancient days, each individual city was apt to be a kingdom by itself. Instead of a mayor, it had a king. And even when it was swallowed up in an empire, why, the head of these subordinate cities were normally tributary kings. They had to pay their tax tribute and furnish an army when needed and so on, but they still held their title of king as a general rule. So Pergamos, while a kingdom, was not one of any great importance or territorial area, until their first king of any great importance, Attalus the First, who reigned from 241 to 149 B.C., began their expansion from Gaul, which is the territory that today we call France. From Gaul, there came an expedition of Gauls landing in Asia Minor. Now, we know, of course, having studied the history of the migrations of the Israel people, from the time they were settled around the southern end of the Caspian Sea and their name became changed to Scythians, that they came in a series of waves north into the Balkans and then angling up north and west across Europe. One of the earliest of these waves had gotten as far as France, where their people were known as Gauls. But they were Scythian Israel. And some of them decided they were going to go back home. And they started an expedition to go back and retake Palestine. And on their way, they landed in Asia Minor, intending to march the rest of the way and see if they could pick up allies as they went. And King Attalus of Pergamos defeated this invasion of Gauls about 235 B.C., and compelled them to move away from his own city and settle in Galatia, a region in Central Asia Minor, and called Galatia because they were the Gauls who settled there. You remember that Paul wrote an epistle to the Galatians, which is in your Bible, and it has been generally supposed by many that it was written to these particular Galatians who were settled in interior Asia Minor. But a great many of the best Bible students have said no, the particular Gauls that he was writing this to were not the Gauls in Asia Minor, they were the Gauls settled in France, in the nation of Gaul there. But at any rate, this King Attalus First was the one who was responsible for the settlement in Galatia of the invading army of Gauls. Now his son Eumenes, who reigned from 197 to 159 B.C., greatly increased the size and importance of the kingdom by an alliance with Rome. The Roman Empire was still expanding, and every time the Romans came through with an army marching out to make more conquests in Asia, why, he raised some troops and went along with them as an ally. And as a reward for that, he was given some portion of the additional conquered territory. So with this, he built up a kingdom here of considerable importance. In the city of Pergamos, he built a great altar, 40 feet high, dedicated to Zeus the Savior. And that, quite possibly, is what is referred to here as Satan's throne. But there are other reasons for calling this the throne or a capital city of Satan at that time, as we'll see when we go into it further. The third important king, Attalus III, who reigned from 138 to 133 B.C., at his death, by will, bequeathed to the Empire of Rome. It was still a republic, remember. But to the Empire of Rome, he bequeathed his kingdom and one more thing, his title as Pontifex Maximus. Now let's find out something about these things. On the fall of Babylon, when he was conquered by the Medes and Persians, the priests of the Babylonian mystery religion, who had tremendous control of things in Babylon, knew they were going to have quite rough going under these new conquerors. So they moved out. They fled. They took with them their religion, and they settled for their headquarters in this town of Pergamos. There was one reason, perhaps, for selecting it. Pergamos already was famous for certain things. It was a center of worship of Asclepius, the healer. They had there a shrine to him and a school of medicine. And the serpent was the emblem of Asclepius. And you note that today the emblem of the medical profession is the staff with the two serpents twined around it, the caduceus, because the earliest time that you find in the pagan religions one who was specifically a healer was Asclepius, whose emblem was the serpent. The worship of Asclepius was conducted with orgies, so common in Asiatic religions. So the priests of the Babylonian mystery religion knew they'd be quite at home there, and they would find a people among whom they could readily make converts. Now this matter of the title of pontiff, that was the title of the more important priest of Babylon. And when they came to Pergamos, they brought the title with them. When the king bequeathed the title of Pontifex Maximus, the greatest of the pontiffs, to Rome, why, it passed to Rome. They organized there a college of pontiffs, four in number, presided over by a Pontifex Maximus. Later, the number was increased to 14, plus the Pontifex Maximus. Now, among the pagan priests in Rome, the two highest out of the four highest classes of priests were the pontiff and the augur. You know from your study of ancient history how much importance was attached among the pagans to trying to predict the future through augury. The priests were supposedly able to predict the future by recognizing certain omens as favorable or unfavorable. In some instances, they would watch for birds flying overhead. A bird flying east might have a very different significance from a bird flying southwest, for example. A flock of birds staying compactly together had a different meaning from a flock that scattered. And hardly ever would a king start out on a war without going to the priest to determine whether the omens were favorable or not. Another way of determining this was to cut open a sacrificed animal and examine the entrails, the inner organs, to see if there was any peculiarity of their appearance, which would indicate a good or a bad omen. In fact, in the ruins of Babylon, they have found clay models of the liver, carefully marked off into a series of squares, and on each written the significance of any particular irregularity found at that particular place. If there was a wrinkle or a bump or something at that particular spot on the liver, why, it had a certain significance. So the augurs were one of the two highest classes of priests, and the pontiffs were the other. Now, the pontiffs were the theologians, the one who reduced their religion to systematic doctrine and taught all the lesser priests. They supervised the calendar, determined when the religious festivals were. They were the officiating priests at the dedication of new temples and other important ceremonies. Now, the Pontifex Maximus, the greatest pontiff, could be, and sometimes was, a king. King Attalus III of Pergamos was Pontifex Maximus. And when the Roman Empire came along, why, the Roman emperors, well, in fact, earlier than that, Julius Caesar, who never got to be emperor, you remember they cut his throat before he could carry out that ambition. But Julius Caesar was a Pontifex Maximus for at least the last 20 years of his life. And thereafter, beginning with his nephew, who became the first emperor under the title of Augustus, thereafter, for several generations, the emperors all took the title of Pontifex Maximus. So you had here the combined character of priest and king. Now, I've told you before, for every genuine thing that God has provided in His Word, Satan has made a deceptive counterfeit.
Amen.
You remember that God said to the people of Israel, "Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." You remember how Jesus Christ combined in one person the two functions of priest and king. The book of Hebrews goes into that in some detail. Jesus Christ was born out of the tribe of Judah, the royal tribe, from which up to that time no priest had been taken. But he was the true high priest, of which the earthly high priest in the temple had been nothing but a symbol. So here you have Satan providing his deceptive counterfeit, a priest-king of a very evil pagan religion. Now, when Julius Caesar exercised his authority at these ceremonies as Pontifex Maximus, he appeared in scarlet robes. He wore on his head a mitre cap as priest of the pagan god Dagon, the fish god, that tall cap with the top cut into the image of a gaping fish mouth. And he carried the keys of the pagan god Janus and the pagan goddess Cybele. Cybele was the same one whose temple it was in the city of Ephesus that caused all the riot against Paul. The keys to the mystery of their religion, were an important pagan emblem. So, who is it that today wears the scarlet robe, the mitre of the priest of Dagon, and says, "I have the keys"? And here's where it began. Julius Caesar claimed that he was a descendant of the Roman goddess Venus. Well, we know, of course, that Venus can be traced back to the Babylonian Ishtar, who can be traced back in turn to Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod. So you can see where all of this has its roots. The Emperor Gratian was the first one who refused the office of Pontifex Maximus, and in fact he abolished it by decree. But about 378 A.D., the office of Pontifex Maximus was claimed by the Pope. From the earliest origin of it, it had never been anything but a pagan high priesthood. Well, getting back to our city of Pergamos for a bit, the Romans reorganized the kingdom of Pergamos into the Roman province of Asia about 130 B.C., and Pergamos became its capital city. Now, the authority of Rome was everywhere manifested by the sword. It was, above all other things, the favorite weapon of the Roman troops, and that was their authority. They ruled by the sword. So you notice here that in addressing the church at Pergamos, Jesus Christ identifies himself as he that has the sharp sword with two edges. If you think that Roman might is something to fear, they're nothing compared to me. I've got the real sword. Now he mentions there Antipas, my faithful martyr. There is no record, either in any of the sacred writings, any of the writings of the early church fathers, or any historical record, of any martyr named Antipas, either in the city of Pergamos or during the period of church existence which was symbolized by the church at Pergamos. So, obviously, it is not speaking then of some one individual. My faithful martyr, Antipas, is therefore representative of a group or class. And who were they? Well, you're going to have to find out that by studying the meaning of a name. It is derived from two Greek words, anti, opposed to, papas, father, pope. You see, the pope took over as part of his title. He called himself the Holy Father. Now, the only place you'll find that mentioned in the Bible is that Jesus Christ alone prayed to his God as Holy Father, and he warned specifically, called no man on earth Father, for you have one Father, which is in heaven. So, these were the martyrs who were martyred for resisting the increasing power of the Pope. Well, Christianity had been tolerated from 313 A.D., became the official Roman religion in 330, starting this period of the Church of Pergamos. And this was a period of the consistently growing power of a priestly hierarchy. You can say that this reached its climax under Pope Gregory III, Gregory the Great, who was pope from 590 to 604 A.D. It is said that somebody once asked Satan, suppose you found a truth so tremendously great and clear and obviously true that you just couldn't fight against it, what would you do? He said, that's easy. I'd organize it. Yeah. Now, the church was undergoing no persecution. It was the official religion of the empire. It received a money subsidy out of the public treasury. It became the fashionable thing to be a Christian, and you got a lot of people into it who were only nominal Christians. But nonetheless, it wasn't taking over the empire fast enough. There were lots and lots of pagans who remained pagans, even though Christianity was the official religion. Now, how to get him into the church? As I say, the more it changes, the more it is the same. You have your evangelists running around all together today. How can we get more people into the church? It doesn't matter whether they believe. It doesn't matter whether they're Christian in their character and conduct. It doesn't matter anything except we have big congregations. And it doesn't matter in the least whether there are doctrinal differences as great between two Christian denominations as between Christianity and paganism. Get them all together in one church. If doctrine is separating us, why abandon the doctrine? Bring it together in one big political organization. Yeah? See what's going on today? Same thing back then. How to bring in the pagans. If you preach true Christianity to them, what attraction do you have for a man who finds the worship of Venus very satisfactory to him because they maintain the temple prostitutes there for his use? You're not competing along that line. You don't have what he's interested in. You're calling him to something that is tough. You're calling him to give up whatever evil qualities he had, whatever bad conduct he had. You're calling upon him to do his utmost, and the painful utmost, to live up to his own highest principles. And you don't get that kind of convert very fast. Well, this thing was brought to its climax under Gregory the First. He enforced it. They said, look, we're making it hard to get in the pagans because we are emphasizing differences between paganism and Christianity. You're telling these people you've got to give up everything you ever thought was holy if you want to become a Christian. Now, that's not good salesmanship. Emphasize the similarity. Show them that it doesn't take much of a change. You can come into a Christian church and be quite comfortable there. Now, you have your own pagan holidays. So the church will adopt the same thing as an official church holiday. And instead of your going to the temple of Jupiter on that day, you come to the Christian church, and instead of calling him Jupiter, you call him St. Peter and worship him. Instead of worshiping Venus as the queen of heaven and the mother of God, you come to this church and you just change the name to the Virgin Mary, and you go right on with your same worship, and you can be part of this big rising popular Christian church. And that's what they did. You will find in the writings of a number of the early Christian followers their bitter condemnation of the fact that whereas the pagans were mostly faithful to their religion and they weren't adopting any Christian ceremonies or any Christian holidays, that the church was adopting pagan holidays and pagan rituals right and left. Well, you had that tremendous drive, as I say, to bring in the pagans and bring in, if need be, pagan worship in order to do it. So, what's the condemnation given of this Church of Pergamos? I have a few things against thee. Thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. Exactly what was being done here. You remember the enemy, after trying to defeat Israel many times by military force and failing, found all they needed to do was induce the Israelites to become apostate from their religion, and then God's protection was withdrawn. And that's what Balaam taught King Balak. He said, you've asked me to curse this people, Israel. I can't. God has blessed them. But however, if you will just deprive them of God's protection, and the only way you can do it is cause them to worship idols, that'll do it. They will be cursed. And I think some 30,000 or something like that of the Israelites died there as a result of it. Then he mentioned that thou hast also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Now this is the period when this was really rising to its great power. Pope Victor I, who was Pope between A.D. 193 and 203. Now remember, he was Bishop of Rome. And you had the church in much greater size, the Eastern Church, in Palestine, Syria, Asia Minor, and Greece. That was a more important church in size, number of congregations, and all that, than the one in Rome. But Rome was the capital city of the empire, and the Pope, as the Bishop of Rome, felt that he should have importance commensurate with that of the city of Rome. So, probably you know that even today, the Eastern Church, the Greek and Russian Orthodox Church, does not follow the same calendar that we do. They have the old calendar under which Christmas and Easter come several days different from what we have under our calendar. Pope Victor I demanded that the Eastern churches adopt the Roman calendar of religious festivals under penalty of excommunication. Well, they told him, go ahead, excommunicate us. You have no authority over anything but the Church of Rome, and we aren't members of the Church of Rome. So he didn't get far with it, but he tried. Now, by the time of Pope Leo I, between 440 and 461, he had very well-developed power over both the Eastern and Roman churches, and he wielded that power ruthlessly. Gregory I was not a theologist, a religious man. He was primarily an administrator over the enormous property holdings of the church. And as administrator, he was forcing upon the entire Catholic Church complete uniformity in all respects. So during this period then, which you can say extends up through the reign of Pope Gregory I to 604, here you have the church developing a priesthood, the Nicolaitans, a professional priesthood triumphing over the laity and setting up their various layers of the cake, each one above the other with their greater authority. And the doctrine of Balaam, teaching the people of Israel to adopt pagan gods and worship.
We will continue this on tape number 2.